motioned them to hang a few yards back from the door. Charlie and the man turned around a few times to inspect and gesture at Josie and her children, and finally Charlie swung around, telling them to come aboard. The ship was garish and loud and crowded, full of glass and screens. The decor was casino crossed with Red Lobster crossed with the court of Louis XVI. The kids were loving it. Anna was running everywhere, touching delicate things, bumping into people, making elderly women and men gasp and reach for walls. "I think it starts in 20 minutes," Charlie said, and then again looked lost. "Let me see if we need tickets." He wandered off, and Josie knew she was a fool. Parenting was chiefly about keeping one's children away from unnecessary dangers, avoidable traumas and disappointments, and here she had dragged them to Alaska and had driven them around unchosen parts of the state, and then to Seward, where no one had recommended they go, and now she had them following a lonely man onto a ship designed, it seemed, by the insane, all to see magic, Luxembourgian magic. Josie paged through the years of her life, trying to remember a decision she had made and was proud of, and she found nothing. Finally, Charlie returned, holding the tickets in his hand like a bouquet. "Are we ready?" There was an escalator inside a ship. Charlie was ahead of them and rode upward while looking back at them, smiling but nervous, as if worried they might flee. The auditorium seated at least 500, and all within was burgundy, like being inside someone's liver. They sat in a half-moon booth near the back, Paul next to Charlie. A waitress in bright red hurried by, and Charlie made no move to order anything. Josie asked for a lemonade for the kids and a glass of Pinot Noir for herself. The drinks arrived, and the lights went down. Her glass was the size of a crystal ball and was nearly full, and Josie felt kissed by the anonymous and irrational generosity of humankind. She relaxed, anticipating a few hours of not having to do anything but sit and watch in silence, getting harmlessly plowed. Charlie had a different plan. The show started, and Josie realized that Charlie intended to talk throughout. And the words he wanted most to say were, "See that?" For Anna, the answer was always, "See what?" So they made a beautiful pair. Charlie would notice something that every member of the audience had seen, and then would ask Josie and her kids if they'd seen it too. Anna would say, "See what?" And Charlie would then explain what he had seen, talking through the next 5 minutes of the show. It was wonderful. The first magician, a pretty man in a tight silk shirt, had, it seemed, been told to make his act more of a personal story, so his monologue returned again and again to the theme of how he had always welcomed magic into his life. Opened the door to magic, said hello to magic. Or how he had learned to appreciate magic in his life. Did he say he was married to magic? Maybe he did. It all made little sense, and the audience seemed lost. "Life is full of magic if you look for it," he noted breathlessly, because he was moving around the stage in 1,000 tiny steps as a woman in a sparkly one-piece bathing suit vamped behind him with long strides. The pretty magician produced some kind of flower from behind a curtain, and Josie struggled to see this as magical. She and Charlie clapped, but few members of the audience joined her. Her children didn't clap. They never clapped, unless she told them to. Were they not taught clapping in school? The magician was not impressing this audience, though who could be easier to impress than 500 elderly people in windbreakers? No, they were waiting for something better than carnations produced from screens. Josie began to feel for this man. He'd been a magician in grade school, no doubt. He'd been pretty then, with lashes so long she could see them now 50 rows back, and as an adolescent, apart from his peers but not concerned about this, he and his mother had driven 40 miles to the nearest city to get the right equipment for his shows, the right boxes with wheels, the velvet bags, the collapsing canes. He loved his mother then and had known how to say it, maybe with a flourish, and his unguarded love for her had made his apartness unimportant to him and her, and now she was so proud that he had made it, was a professional magician, traveling the world making magic, welcoming magic into his life. All that, Josie thought. And these elderly assholes won't clap for him. Josie downed half her Pinot and gave the pretty magician a whoop. If no one else appreciated him, she would. Every time he asked for applause, which was often, she yelled and whooped and clapped. Her children looked at her, unsure if she was being funny. Charlie turned to her and smiled nervously. Now, the long-legged woman was helping the pretty magician into a big red box. Now she was turning it around and around. It was on wheels. Everything in the act had to be on wheels so it could be turned around. It was a rule of magic on stage that everything must be turned around and around to prove there were no strings, no one hiding just behind. But in its absence, did the audience ever wonder about the turning around? Did they ever ask, why hasn't someone turned the box around? Turn the box around! My God, turn it! Now the sparkly assistant opened the box. The pretty man was not in the box. Josie whooped again, clapping over her head. Where had he gone? The suspense was fantastic. And now he was next to them. Suddenly, a spotlight was on their table or near it because the pretty man was next to them. Holy shit, Josie said, loud enough that the pretty man, whose hands were outstretched, again asking for applause, heard her. He smiled. Josie clapped louder, but again the rest of the audience didn't seem to care. He was up there, she wanted to yell to them. Now he's here, you fuckers. Up close, she saw the magician was wearing a tremendous amount of makeup, eyeliner, blush, maybe even lipstick, all seemingly applied by a child. Then the spotlight went dark. And he stood for a moment, next to their table, hands up, while a second magician appeared on stage. Josie wanted to say something to the pretty man, a heaving silken silhouette a few feet away, but by the time she arrived at what she would say, "We loved you," he was gone. She turned to the stage. The new magician was less pretty. "This is the one from Luxembourg," Charlie whispered. "Hello, everyone!" The new magician roared and explained he was from Michigan. Oh, Charlie sighed. The Michigan magician, red-haired in a white shirt and stretchy black pants, was soon in a straitjacket and was hanging upside down 20 feet above the stage. He explained, his breath labored and his arms crossed like a chrysalis, that if he did not escape from the straitjacket in some certain amount of time, something unfortunate would happen to him. Josie, trying to get the attention of the waitress, had not caught exactly what that consequence was. She ordered a second Pinot, and soon some part of the contraption holding the magician was on fire. Was that intentional? It seemed intentional. Then he was struggling in an inelegant way, ramming his shoulders against the canvas jacket, and then, aha, he was free and was standing on the ground. An explosion flowered above him, but he was safe and not on fire. Josie thought this trick pretty good and clapped heartily, but again, the crowd was not impressed. What were they waiting for, she wondered. Fuckers. Then she knew. They were waiting for the magician from Luxembourg. They did not want domestic magic. They wanted magic from abroad. The man from Michigan stood at the edge of the stage, bowing again and again, and instead of the applause growing, it dissipated until he was bowing in silence. Josie thought of his poor mother and hoped she was not on this cruise, but she knew there was a very good chance the Michigan magician's mother was on this cruise. How could she not be on this cruise? Now, a new magician appeared. He had a high head of gleaming yellow hair, and his pants were somehow tighter than the pants of his predecessors. Josie had not thought this possible.
"I hope this guy's from Luxembourg," Charlie said, too loudly. "Hello," the magician said, and Josie was fairly sure he was from somewhere else. Perhaps Luxembourg? The magician explained that he spoke 6 languages and had been everywhere.
he asked if anyone in the audience had been to Luxembourg, and a smattering of applause surprised him. Josie decided to clap too, and did so loudly.
Yes, she yelled. I've been there.
Her children were horrified.
Yes,
she yelled again,
and it was great.
Lots of visitors to Luxembourg, I am pleased,
the magician said, though he didn't seem to believe those who had applauded, least of all Josie. But by now, her spirit dancing in the glorious light of her second overpoured glass of Pinot, Josie believed she had been to Luxembourg. In her youth, she'd backpacked through Europe for 3 months. And wasn't Luxembourg right there in the middle of the continent? Surely she'd been there. Did that one train, the main train, go to Luxembourg? Of course it did. She pictured a beer garden in a castle, on a hill, by the sea. What sea? Some sea. Puff the Magic Dragon. The magician from Luxembourg did his tricks, which seemed more sophisticated than those of his predecessors, maybe because they involved roses? Before him, there had been only carnations. The roses, this was a step up. Women holding roses appeared in boxes, boxes on wheels, and the man from Luxembourg turned these boxes around and around. Then he opened the boxes, and the women would not be there. They were somewhere else, behind screens, in the audience. Josie clapped and hollered. He was wonderful. The wine was wonderful. What a good world this was, that there was magic like this on ships like this. What an impressive species they were, humans, who could build a ship like this, who could do magic like this, who could clap listlessly even for the magician from Luxembourg. These fucking assholes, Josie thought, trying to single-handedly make up for their sickening lack of enthusiasm. Why come out to a magic show if you don't want to be entertained? Clap, you criminals! She hated these people. Even Charlie wasn't clapping enough. She leaned over to him. Not good enough for you? She asked, but he didn't hear. Now, Luxembourg was gone, and a man was making his way onto the stage. He was rumpled, his hair reaching upward 7 different ways, and he was easily 20 years older than the others. Another man. Where were the women? Were women not capable of magic? Josie tried to conjure any female magician she'd ever seen or heard of and couldn't. My God, she thought, how can that be? Scandal, injustice, what about Lady Magic? Lady Magic, yes. Why do we allow all these men, all these silken, heavy-breathing men, and now this one, this rumpled one? He made no effort at all to be pretty like the others. He had no lovely assistant, and, it soon became clear, he didn't intend to do any magic. God damn you, Josie thought, guessing all the magic was over. And did she have money for another drink? She had about $25, she guessed. Maybe the drinks were cheaper on board than on Alaskan soil. She had to count on it. She looked for the waitress. Where was the waitress? There was only the rumpled man standing at the edge of the stage. Now he was telling the audience that he'd worked for some time at a post office and had memorized most zip codes. Holy crap, Josie thought. He'll get murdered. What kind of world is this, she thought, when a man from the post office follows Luxembourgian magic? And why were they, she and her kids, on this ship in the first place? With incredible clarity, she knew then that the answer to her life was that at every opportunity, she made precisely the wrong choice. She was a dentist, but did not want to be a dentist. What could she do now? She was sure, at that moment, that she was meant to be a tugboat captain. My God, she thought. My God, at 40, she finally knew she would lead the ships to safety. That's why she'd come to Seward. There had to be a tugboat school in town. It all made sense. She could do that, and her days would be varied, but always heroic. She looked at her children and saw that Paul was now leaning against Charlie, asleep. Her son was asleep against this strange old man, and they were in Seward, Alaska. For the first time, she realized how Seward sounded like sewer and thought this an unfortunate thing, given Seward as a place was very dramatic and very clean, and she thought it very beautiful, maybe the most beautiful place she'd ever been. It was here she would stay, and train to become a tugboat captain at the school that she would find tomorrow. All was aligned. All was right. And now, looking at her son sleeping against this man, this old man who was leaning forward, listening to the post office man talk about the post office, she felt her eyes welling up. She took a final sip from her second Pinot and wondered if she'd ever been happier. No, never, impossible. This old man had found them, and it could not be coincidence. This town was now their home, the site of this ordained and holy reunion, and all the people around them were congregants, all of them exalted and now part of her life, her new life, the life she was meant for, tugboat captain. Oh, yes, it had all been worth it. She sat back, knowing she'd arrived at her destiny. On stage, the post office man was telling the audience that for anyone who gave him a postal code, he could tell them what town they were from. Josie thought this was some sort of a comedy bit, that he was kidding about the postal job. But immediately someone stood up and yelled, 83303!
Twin Falls, Idaho, he said. Unincorporated part of town.
The crowd erupted. The cheers were deafening. None of the magicians had elicited this kind of enthusiasm, nothing close. Now 10 people were standing up, yelling their zip codes. Josie, despairing for the waitress who had not returned, downed half a glass of water. And that act, the dilution of the holy wine within her, took her away from the golden light of grace she'd felt moments before, and now she was sober, or something like it. Tugboat captain? Some voice was now speaking to her. What kind of imbecile are you? She didn't like this new voice. This was the voice that had told her to become a dentist, who told her to have children with that man, the loose-boweled man, the voice who every month told her to pay her water bill. She was being pulled back from the light, like an almost angel, now being led back to the mundanity of earthly existence. The light was shrinking to a pinhole, and the world around her was darkening to an everywhere burgundy. She was back inside the liver-colored room, and a man was talking about postal codes.
Okay, you now, the postal man said, and pointed to a white-haired woman in a fleece vest.
62914, she squealed.
Cairo, Illinois, he said, explaining that though it was spelled like the city in Egypt, it was pronounced Cairo, the Illinois way. Nice town, he said.
The audience screamed, hooted. It was a travesty. Now Paul was awake, groggy, and wondering what all the noise was about. Josie couldn't bear it. The noise was not about magic and tugboats. It was about zip codes.
33950, someone yelled. Punta Gorda, Florida, the man said.
The crowd roared again. Anna looked around, unable to figure out what was happening. What was happening? Postal codes were making these people lose their minds. They all wanted to have their town named by the rumpled man with the microphone. They yelled their five digits, and he guessed Shoshone, Idaho, New Paltz, New York, and Santa Ana, California. It was a melee. Josie feared people would storm the stage to rip his clothes off. Go back to sleep, Paul, Josie wanted to say. She wanted to flee. Everything was wrong about all this, but she couldn't leave because now Charlie was standing up.
63005, he yelled.
The spotlight found him, and he repeated the numbers.
63005. Chesterfield, Missouri, the postal man said.
Charlie's mouth dropped open. The spotlight remained on him for a few seconds, and Charlie's mouth stayed open, a black cave in the white light. Finally, the light moved on. He was in darkness again, as if a spirit had held him aloft and suddenly let go. He sat down.
Hear that?
He said to Paul. He turned to Josie and Anna, his eyes wet and his hands trembling.
Hear that? That man knows where I come from.
Afterward, on the gangplank, Charlie offered to walk them back to the chateau. Josie declined and kissed his cheek. Give Charlie a hug and say thanks, she told her kids. Anna rushed in and hugged Charlie's legs. He put his hand on her back, his fingers spread like the ancient roots of a tiny tree. Paul moved closer but stopped, hoping, it seemed, that Charlie would fill the distance between them. Now Charlie was on one knee and his hands were outstretched. Paul shuffled toward him and Charlie brought him in, and Paul's head dropped onto Charlie's shoulder with something like relief.
Let's write letters, Charlie said into Paul's hair.
Paul nodded and pulled back, as if to see if Charlie was serious. Josie knew Paul would obsess about these letters, and she was terrified by the possibility that she would have to offer their address to this man.
How?
Paul asked. Can we send a letter to a ship? Charlie didn't know. He fumbled in his pocket and brought out what turned out to be an itinerary.
Just take it, he said to Josie,
and she saw that on it was the ship's every port of call.
Chapter 4. In the white light morning, Josie had not slept well, and her mood was apocalyptic. It was not a matter of falling asleep. After the magic show, they'd walked the mile home along the waterfront, the night brisk and the moon bright. They walked past the fishing boats to the end of the docks, and then along the dirt road and through the woods until reaching the chateau. Anna and Paul had been animated at first, recounting the show, asking questions about Charlie, where he was from, and when he would die. Anna wondered this, throwing a stone into the cold water. But then, when they arrived at the chateau, the kids were silent, somber, and didn't bother to take off their jeans or socks before dropping off to sleep. After a nightcap of Pinot, the last of the second bottle, she deserved it, given all she'd done and endured. Josie climbed up to join them and fell asleep readily. But at first light, she awoke, as she often did, her mind leaping with the realization that she had indeed killed that young man. Some young prosecutor with Josie's own face. It was her, but younger, and with hair in a high, tight bun, a great suit. This legal version of herself was leaping around a courtroom, wood-paneled and filled with sensible citizens, insisting upon it. Convict this woman! Hold her accountable! Josie opened the door to the quiet woods and walked to the waterfront. The sun was beginning to bring pale color to the mountains on the bay's far shore. She squinted at the water's blinding shimmer and beyond, the otherworldly glow of the low sun on the mountain snow. She walked across the beach, almost stepping on the otter skull her children had presented to her the day before. She sat down again on her petrified white tree stump and raked her hands through the gravelly sand, lifting a handful, letting it pass through her fingers. Jeremy. He'd been a patient since he was 12. One of those boys who said, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you, ma'am. He had beautiful teeth. Every time she saw him, she hoped for cavities, loved seeing him that much, but it was only twice a year in the office, a cleaning, a checkup, some conversation, and the occasional sighting on the street. The kind of boy who, when they ran into him at the park, he would leave his group, a group of teenagers lying about, a pride of lazy lions doing nothing on the park bench by the creek, and he would jog over and crouch down and talk to Paul and Anna, would offer them whatever gum or mints he had in his pocket. His parents were not well off, but they were solid. Both worked for the city and had good health plans. The father was from Venezuela, the mother from Cuba, and they began to come for checkups too, on his recommendation. Jeremy had vouched for Josie, was the light of the family, and though the parents weren't nearly as talkative or preternaturally aglow as their son, they all liked to talk about Jeremy. How could we make more Jeremys? He had four younger siblings, and he knew everything about each one of them. Josie could ask any detail. How's little Ashley? And he'd have a story. What's the baby doing now? Then he was 17, 18, and had become a tall and strikingly handsome young man with a boomerang jawline. Tanya, the hygienist, took notice of the way he filled a room, 6'2", his wide shoulders, and made sure to brush her breasts against him as she cleaned his teeth. His bright green eyes, his unblemished flesh, his impossibly smooth chin. He did not need to shave, he said.
No, ma'am. Once or twice a year is all I need right now.
He smiled and ran his hands over his noble face. He played soccer, lacrosse, and then, at Josie's doing, she insisted when she signed up, he had been Paul's counselor at the rec center summer day camp. Paul was no athlete, but had been treated with special consideration. Jeremy had given him a nickname, El Toro, because Paul had one day worn a t-shirt bearing the silhouette of a bull, and Paul grinned shyly when Jeremy yelled the name across the street from his car window whenever he saw Paul in town. El Toro! Charge! Josie had found it written on all the flyers Paul took home from camp. Under name of camper, Jeremy had always written, in bold, all capitals, El Toro, even the exclamation point. After summer camp, she'd been one of the many mothers who asked Jeremy to babysit. So rare to have a male babysitter, she said, every other mother said. She'd been able to wrangle his services 3 times, and as far as she could tell, he had spent each of those nights being attacked with affection by her children. Were they so starved of contact? When she got home, she would find them asleep, their hair matted to the pillow, Jeremy on the couch, exhausted, smelling sweetly of sweat, and he would tell her about the night. They'd eaten their pizza, he'd say, and as they walked away from the table, Anna had leaped on him like a wolverine.
I don't think she let go for the next 3 hours, he said.
Paul was reticent at first, but soon the three of them were wrestling, were jousting with Jeremy's lacrosse sticks and shields made from couch cushions.
But mostly wrestling, me on the ground and them jumping on me like little animals. They're pretty physical, way more than Paul was at camp, Jeremy said.
Convinced that they were expelling some latent aggression toward their absent father, that this could only be healthy, she asked Jeremy to come back, and he did, 2 more times. And each time the battles grew more epic, the final one taking place in the backyard.
They would have broken something in the house otherwise, Jeremy explained. Anna called me Dad at one point when I was brushing her teeth. It was pretty funny. Paul was embarrassed.
Josie was mortified. Did Jeremy know that Carl had moved out? Was he old enough to know that her children were starving for a male presence in the house and that her daughter, being 4, had virtually no memory, would be happy with Jeremy as a replacement man, that he could eclipse and erase Carl in a matter of weeks?
So were you in Panama?
He asked, pointing to a photo of Josie with a dozen Peace Corps volunteers. She'd spent her 2 years in Boca del Lobo, and it was a mixed bag. A few successes, a few friends, the whole issue with her friend Rory, now in prison, but still. Good work could be done, she said. Jeremy didn't know what he would do after high school. This was the fall of his senior year. She had assumed he would have had a sturdy plan by then, limitless college options.
I don't want to be in more classrooms right away, he said,
and turned at the sound of footsteps. It was Anna, awake, in her Buzz Lightyear pajamas. Josie stretched out her arms, and Anna rushed to her, but then paused between them, as if wanting to fall into her mother's arms, but afraid this would alienate Jeremy in some way, would hurt the chances he'd come back. Instead, she did a sort of twist dance on the carpet and said, "Champagne on my shoulders." She'd been saying that recently.
"Step here," Jeremy said, crouched on the floor, putting his palms out.
Anna did not hesitate. She put 1 bare foot on each of his hands, balancing herself with her hands on his shiny black head. Her eyes betrayed that she didn't know what would happen, but was certain it would be incredible and worth any risk.
"Okay, now let go," he said.
She obeyed.
Now he slowly rose to his full height, somehow balancing Anna on his palms with such sureness that she felt free to spread her arms wide as if receiving the bounty of the sun.
My dad used to do that with me, he said,
barely exerting any effort, this 40-pound child still standing on his hands. Now he lifted her higher.
Can you get the ceiling?
He asked. Anna reached, grunting, until she tapped it with her finger.
Down, please, she said,
and he lowered her slowly, then dropped her in a heap on the couch and pretended to sit on her, trying to get comfortable as she shrieked gleefully below.
You're a great mom, Jeremy said to Josie, still sitting on Anna. I mean, in general, but especially because you let me do stuff like this. Not all parents do. The kids are beasts. They need to sweat and scream and wrestle.
Jeremy collected Anna in his arms and plunged his mouth into her stomach, making a loud, wet raspberry. Anna's eyes were charged, her hands like claws in front of her, waiting for the next attack. But instead, Jeremy smoothed her shirt, patted her tummy, and stood her up on the carpet, as if restoring a fallen statue.
Thank you, Josie said, overcome.
In return for Jeremy's kindness and strength, all Josie had ever wanted was to tell him how much she felt he was the hope of the world. Is that all she did? No, she said more, and this is why she should not speak ever again, and why she cherished every day when she spoke to no one but her two children. She knew that the color of the sky affected her moods, the sun changed her outlook and words, and if she took a brisk walk during lunch and saw something beautiful, she was liable to say something exuberant or be too full of happiness for an hour or so, and this was when she made mistakes. In her exuberance, she would reveal too much about herself, she would overpraise, she would urge people into tasks they could not complete. It happened 2 weeks after that night. She had come back from lunch and was feeling some joy the fall air had given her and could hardly concentrate. She had 3 patients that afternoon, and all were subjected to her inane bliss. First, there was Joanna Pasquese, a Rubenesque high school sophomore who revealed she was considering going out for the school musical. It was a chorus line that year, and with altogether too much zeal, Josie urged her to try out, to make their selection of her beyond debate, and went on a bit about the need for body diversity on the stage, though in reality, she was trying to score a very belated victory against the gatekeepers who had kept her out of her own high school musical, Cabaret, for which Josie was not called back. So Joanna Pasquese, who had actually checked her watch twice while Josie rambled on, left feeling inspired. She said so at least, though she might have been simply stunned into submission. And then Jeremy came in, and they talked for a time about her kids. Such cool kids, he said. And they laughed about their hyperactivity, their madness, their need to wrestle with him, touch ceilings with him, and then conversation turned to her and the Peace Corps. And though she rarely was so exuberant about it, this time she told him it was the greatest experience of her life, that they had made such a difference there, that it was just after the country had taken ownership of the canal, that there was such optimism then, so many changes, and that being part of that transition, representing the U.S. in Panama, this crucial partner at a crucial moment, she went on, and it was wildly convincing. Even Tanya was listening. And then, with his smooth young face and sincerity, Jeremy told her he wanted to enlist. He wanted to be a Marine. He wanted to make a difference in Afghanistan, help open schools for Afghan girls, work on clean water projects, bring stability to a country on the verge of great things. Josie's eyes filled, and she squeezed his shoulder. She did not do what good people would have done, which would have been to say nothing. Enlisting during a war was such a grave business that only an idiot would praise this notion. Josie should have been judicious enough to know that she could not, should not influence such a decision in any way, to recognize that this was between Jeremy and his parents, to know that she was nothing. But she was a fool, who knew no boundaries and was not very sure about the state of the war. She was relatively certain it was winding down and would present little danger to Jeremy. So she told him that sounded wonderful, that he, as the hope of the world, a gentle soul, a formidable figure, could make such a difference, that the Marines, that the region, that Afghanistan itself needed someone like him. Somehow, she had confused her enthusiasm for Joanna Pasquese's musical ambitions with Jeremy's nation-building hopes, and further, had conflated her own time in Panama, the expression of American love through cisterns and the teaching of English by men and women in sandals and khakis, for the impulse did come from love, love of the world, with Jeremy's expression of the same love, though in uniform and carrying an AK-47, it was not the same thing. And now he was dead, and his parents hadn't spoken to her since. "This has absolutely nothing to do with you," her friend said, bewildered that she would take any responsibility at all. But then why hadn't his parents been back? Josie had heard later that they'd been against his enlisting from the start, and what they didn't know, and she would never tell them and had not told anyone, was that he had approached her in the parking lot of her office one evening at 5. He knew when she'd be there, weeks after that visit where she squeezed his shoulder and said, "Wonderful," and told her that her support had been so important to him, that his parents had been unsure, they'd been worried, but they had respect for her, for Josie, his dentist, that her support had meant so much to them and him. He had enlisted and was killed 6 months later. This is why she no longer offered advice, why she was happy to let go of her practice, liberated, thrilled, away and free. This was why, outside her parenting duties, she had not left her bedroom most of January, her limbs unliftable and her face numb. No one had told her. Not the parents, none of their friends. The funeral had already happened. He'd been shot in some remote Afghani hillside and had bled for 6 hours before dying. He'd had time to write a note to his parents, which had been found on him, the contents of which Josie would never know. A boy of 18 dying alone, bleeding alone, writing to his parents. How did all this happen? How was this allowed? Josie wanted no more of this. This idea of knowing people. Knowing people meant telling them what to do or not to do, providing advice, encouragement, guidance, wisdom, and all of these things brought misery and lonely death. "Mom?" It was Paul. Josie turned. Her son was in yesterday's clothes and had somehow gotten out of the chateau, walked through the woods, across the parking lot, and found her there on the shore. "We're hungry," he said. They ate in the camp cafeteria, the eggs and sausage excellent and costing only $55 before gratuity. The Norwegians ate nearby, waving again. There was a television hanging from the ceiling, showing a loop of the park's services, iceberg tours, glacier tours, whale watching, each excursion costing somewhere in the thousands per person, and every so often there was a public service announcement featuring Smokey the Bear. Josie had forgotten about his very existence, hadn't seen him since her Girl Scout days, and between then and now, something had happened. He'd been working out. The cuddly and round-bellied old Smokey was now a burly bear with a flat stomach and arms like bent steel. In the animated message, his friends were trying to give him a birthday party, and they carried out a cake full of lighted candles. Smokey didn't like this. He gave them a disapproving posture, his huge arms on his waist, and Josie felt a stirring within her. Did she have a crush on this new Smokey? Her table shook. Someone had bumped it. An older man turned to apologize, but his wife spoke first. "Nimble as a cat," the woman said, her voice a patrician purr. Josie looked up to her, laughed, and took in the woman's face. It was beautiful, with an upturned nose, a delicate chin. She had to be 70. Hearing Josie's laugh, the woman turned again to her. "I'm sorry, he's just lost a step lately. He was a very debonair man, even last month.
The woman smiled, turned away, evidently embarrassed. She'd said too much.
Who are those people?
Anna asked. Josie shrugged. Her daughter's face was streaked with dirt and dried snot. Josie had seen a sign for showers available at the campground, somewhere in a vast log cabin in the woods, so after breakfast they put on flip-flops, bought the necessary tokens, and brought their shampoo and soap and towels. They undressed, leaving their clothes high in a cubby, and stepped across the plywood floor to the women's shower area, where there were two young women, each of them facing out, unabashed and vigorously shampooing their hair. They were ravishing creatures, taut and tanned, with tiny breasts alive and alert, and their teeth were white, their asses high and shiny, and pubic hair artistically groomed. Josie stared at them as she would a pair of unicorns. What are you doing here? She wanted to ask, though she had no better idea of where they should be. Where does young beauty belong? Maybe stepping through fountains in Rome, calling, Marcello, Marcello! Or on a plane, piloting a plane. Josie pictured the two of them flying a plane through pillowy clouds, each wearing white, their legs uncovered and so smooth. One of the young women was now looking back at Josie, who in her reverie was caught staring, and now she was telling her friend they were being watched, and soon they were hustling out of the shower and into towels. Josie thought of her parents, both nurses at a veterans hospital, how they taught her how to dry herself after a shower. Her mother and father mimed the brushing of all excess water from their arms and legs, left arm, left leg, right leg, saving the towel for whatever was left. Josie thought of their demonstration. They'd done it in the living room when she was 8, every time she showered. Many days it was the only time she thought of them. What did that say about her? About the limits of memory, the threshold for the tolerance of pain? Seeing they had the showers to themselves, Anna ran naked into the mist. Would she break into song? Josie got up and Paul followed. They hung their cheap, rough towels on rough hooks, and the three of them formed a tight circle, facing one another, the warm water falling between them. Anna looked between Paul's legs and said,
"Hello, penis."
It was not the first time she'd greeted Paul's machinery. He'd gotten used to it and took some pride in being the only member of the household so equipped. Josie soaked their bodies and shampooed their hair, Anna making underwater sounds and stamping her feet. We gravitate toward comfort, Josie thought, but it must be rationed. Give us 1/3 comfort and 2/3 chaos. That is balance. Their hair wet and bodies clean, they stepped out of the hygiene cabin and into the dappled sunlight, and Josie felt they were in the right place. The last few days, their many trials, were only adjustments. Now she knew what she was doing, she had the hang of it, and all was possible. They rested a while in the chateau, during which time Paul brought Josie a card, dictated by Anna and written by Paul, which said, "I love you, Mom. I am a robot." That settled, they walked back into town.
Mom,
Paul said,
was that show good?
The magic show? Yeah, she said. Did you think so?
He nodded, utterly unsure. Where the town met the onslaught of the rough black bay, there was a monument to Seward with a long accounting of why the town had been named after Lincoln's trusted advisor. Josie tried to explain it all to her children, but they needed context. Okay, who freed the slaves? She finally asked. Paul knew the answer, so Josie raised her finger to allow a moment for Anna to try. Anna thought about it for some time, and then a light entered her eyes.
Was it Dad?
Josie laughed, snorting, and Paul rolled his eyes. Anna knew she said something funny, so continued saying it.
Dad freed the slaves! Dad freed the slaves!
Near the monument, there was a rocky beach decorated with wild debris and driftwood. They walked amid great, rough-hewn beams, big as truck axles and thrown ashore like pencils. Paul picked up a steering wheel, and Anna found the remains of a buoy smashed into the shape of a child's torso. Josie sat on a round rock and felt the salt air rush at her. Happiness swelled inside her with equal force, and she wanted to stay there all day, all night, wanted to live in that moment for as long as was allowed. She was right when she thought, every hour, that children, or at least her children, needed to be outside, amid rough things, and all she needed, beyond feeding them, was to sit on rounded rocks, watching them lift things and occasionally throw them back to the sea. The sand was damp, a deep brown, dusted by lighter clouds of dry sand. Soon, Paul and Anna sat on either side of her.
"What's that smell?" Paul asked, though Josie smelled nothing. "It's really bad," he said.
And then Josie saw something. There was a large stone in front of them, the size of a shoe, and it looked like it had recently been dislodged and replaced. Josie lifted it, and the smell flew upward and filled the air. She replaced the stone, but had seen, in a glance, a terrible thing. It was feces, and there might have been some sort of diaper there, too. She thought about it, examining the memory of what she'd seen. No, that wasn't it. The answer came to her. It was a maxi pad. It was a maxi pad covered in caramel-colored feces. "Let's move," she said, and hustled Paul and Anna up from the beach, past the monument to the great man, and through town. There could be no doubt that humans were the planet's most loathsome creatures. No other animal could have done something so wretched. Someone, an outdoors someone, came to this shore knowing it was beautiful and rough. Then they had shat here, even though there was a bathroom 200 yards away. They had shat in such a way that most of the feces was attached to the maxi pad. The physics of it, Josie couldn't conjure. And then, instead of bringing the shit-covered maxi pad to a garbage receptacle, one only 50 yards away, they had left it under a rock, which showed some strange mixture of shame and aesthetics. They knew no one would want to see the shit-covered maxi pad, so they hid it under a rock, where they surely knew it would never decompose. So they walked into downtown Seward, and Josie, feeling magnanimous to compensate for the depravity of the rest of humankind, allowed Anna and Paul to explore the souvenir shops and bought them each horrifying talking moose t-shirts and snow globes. They walked along the waterfront, and after half a mile found a vast green park with an elaborate play structure full of blonde and black-haired children.
"Can we go?"
Paul asked. But Anna had already run ahead, crossing a parking lot where she narrowly missed being crushed by a truck backing out. For all her young life, Josie had had to envision the tiny coffin, the words she would say, life without this girl. Anna was doing everything she could to bring herself to an early end, and the force and focus she brought to the endeavor could not be overcome. Oblivious, she ran through the wood chips and would remain among the living for at least another hour. Josie found a bench, set the bags of horrible souvenirs down, and watched Anna tear through the play structure. Next to her, Paul was standing still, hands at his sides, carefully examining the playground, seeing its many features, judiciously deciding which would be best to experience first. Josie opened the free newspaper she'd been handed outside one of the stores, while keeping an eye on Anna, who she knew at some point would throw herself from the slide or find some new way to land on her head. Soon, Anna stopped, had spotted a small skate park nearby, and was mesmerized by the teenagers in their gear. For no reason, Josie remembered something Carl had written in a folded note slipped under the pillow. "I will never tire of your sweet ass." Was that sexy? His handwriting was a murderer's scrawl. Otherwise, Carl didn't take sex seriously. He liked to make jokes during and after. "Well done," he'd say afterward, immediately afterward, obliterating any mood, extinguishing any afterglow. When Josie told him she'd rather do without the jokes, he was so sad. He loved his jokes.
After that, whenever he'd finish, she could see him staring up at the ceiling, wanting to say, "Good work," or, "I think that worked out pretty well," but unable to. She'd squashed this crucial avenue of self-expression.
"Okay, locals against tourists," a kid yelled.
He was in the playground, standing in an area between Anna and Paul, and seemed to be about 12, black-haired and handsome, and was organizing all the kids on the playground. He was a leader. If there were ever a true thing, it was that some people, some children, some infants, were leaders, and some were not. And in seconds, he had divided 18 children into teams, and Paul grabbed Anna, and all the smaller children were dutifully listening to the boy's instructions.
"This is how it works," the boy leader announced, shaking his long, raven black hair out of his eyes. "It's like tag, but instead of being tagged, it's like you're a zombie, and you die if your neck's broken, like this."
Then, as Josie watched, horrified and helpless, he took Paul, put his hands on either side of Paul's head, and twisted quickly, mimicking the breaking of someone's neck as done in action films.
"Now fall," the boy said, and Paul dutifully crumpled. "That's how it works. You're dead until the game ends, then we start over. Everyone got it?"
Anna's eyes were huge. From fear or fascination, Josie didn't know, but she did know she was leaving, and her kids were leaving. Seeing a 12-year-old pretend to break her son's neck had left her cold. She waved Paul over, as if she had some casual, unrelated news or instruction, then grabbed his arm and didn't let go.
"Anna!"
she yelled, and they walked off. Anna soon followed. Seward had been nice, but it was time to go. They still had a day to kill before Homer, so they packed up the chateau, Josie filled the tank, $212, an abomination, bought a map, and left town.
"Where are we going, Mom?" Paul asked.
"Put a seatbelt on," Josie said. Chapter 5. This was a different way of making plans. Sam had said that she would meet Josie at 5 p.m. on Monday, and because Josie had no phone and Sam never picked up hers, the plan would have to suffice and be honored. By Josie's calculations, if they drove straight from Seward to Homer, they'd make it by noon, 5 hours early. There was supposed to be a barbecue on the beach to welcome them, Josie and her kids. She caught Paul looking at her in the rearview mirror. He was assessing, gauging whether or not his mother knew what she was doing. She looked back at him, projecting competence. Her hands were on the wheel. She had her sunglasses on. She had a map on the passenger seat and directions to Homer.
"I'm dubious," his eyes said.
"Screw off," her eyes responded. Josie turned the radio knob left and right, occasionally securing a signal in the middle, and when it was clear, it seemed to be broadcasting a Broadway marathon. Gwen Verdon in Redhead. These were obscure songs. Songs known only to someone whose formative years were engulfed by the maniacal sounds of musicals, known and obscure, failed and world-dominating, most of them sounding tinny now and desperate to please. Her relationship to the music was complicated at best, tied up as it was with her parents' work and devolution. The musicals had happened when she was 9. She hadn't known her parents to be interested in any music at all. The family owned no stereo. There was a radio in the kitchen, but when it was on, rarely, it was tuned to the news. There were no records, no tapes, no CDs. But then one day, there were boxes of records, vinyl black holes, spread all over the floor. Her parents were nurses in the psych ward, though they brought little of the work home. As a child, Josie heard them mention restraints and Thorazine burps, heard them discuss the man who thought he was a lizard, the man who made imaginary phone calls all day, using a spoon. But now there was homework. They'd been put in charge of bringing music to the ward. Their supervisor had encouraged them to keep the music upbeat and clean and distracting. Everyone had settled on Broadway musicals as the least likely to provoke murder and suicide. With a borrowed record player
and 50 LPs bought at an estate sale. A music teacher in the next town had died. Their home was filled for the next few years with Jesus Christ Superstar, deemed too thought-provoking, and Anne of Green Gables, wonderful, foreign, unrelatable, and On the Town, perfect, as it described a healthier approach to the home life of enlisted men. They would listen to a new one every night, were required to examine every song, every word for its appropriateness, its ability to cut through misery and uplift. Patterns emerged. Irving Berlin was fine. Stephen Sondheim too complex, morally problematic. West Side Story, including, as it did, gangs and knives, was out. My Fair Lady, being about nothing the veterans recognized as their lives, was in. Older musicals about presumably simpler times prevailed. Oklahoma and Carousel and The King and I quickly made their way into rotation, while South Pacific was shelved. They wanted nothing about soldiers still fighting any foreign war. So many well-known shows were tabled in favor of less troubling but forgotten shows that now only Josie could recall. Jackie Gleason in Take Me Along, a vehicle for Gleason to be Gleason. Richard Durr and Sherrill Conway in Plain and Fancy, about New Yorkers in Amish country. Pippin was out, the words circled by her father, then crossed out. And then the men go marching out into the fray, conquering the enemy and carrying the day. Hark, the blood is pounding in our ears, jubilations. We can hear a grateful nation's cheers. That wouldn't work. The first musical Josie remembered well was Redhead, a show built around Gwen Verdon. The first seconds of the record were a revelation. Everything was manic. The wall of delirious optimism appealed to her as a child, though her parents studied the words for controversy. They consulted her sometimes, danced with her occasionally. There was a time when their home had something in common with the bizarre happiness of dozens of people singing from a stage to darkened strangers who'd paid for joy and release. She remembered her mother on her back with her legs in the air, doing some kind of yoga stretch, her father trying to put Josie on his shoulders to dance, finding the ceiling too low. Her hitting her head, the two of them laughing, her mother admonishing, and the musical went on. Josie, in those years, pictured her parents' lives at work as a similar sort of nonstop party, the soldiers dancing too, with their simple and solvable problems, broken arms and legs, a few days in and then out again, her parents serving them jello and fluffing their pillows. "It smells," Anna said from the back. Josie turned down the radio. "What's that?" she asked. Paul agreed. Something was off. Anna suggested skunk, but it was not skunk. It smelled like something in the engine, but then again, it wasn't the smell of oil or gears or gasoline. Josie opened the windows in the cab, and Paul opened the kitchen windows. The smell dissipated, but was still present. "I can really smell it here," Paul said. Anna said her head hurt. Then Paul had a headache, too. At a rest stop, Josie pulled over and crawled back to the kitchenette. Now the smell was much stronger. It was a faintly industrial smell that spoke of great evil. "Get out," she said. Anna thought this was funny and pretended to be asleep, her head resting on the kitchenette table. "Now," Josie yelled. And Paul unbuckled her and pushed her in front of him until the two of them were down the steps. "Get on the grass," Josie said. Now she knew what it was. The gas was on. All four knobs had been turned full right. She had the momentary thought that she should jump out, that the whole vehicle might explode if she even touched the stove. But inexplicably, wanting to preserve the chateau, their new home, she reached over, turned all four knobs hard left, and then jumped down from the doorway, pushing Paul and Anna, who were standing on the grass, Paul behind Anna, hands on her shoulders, until they were all 50 yards away and panting. The chateau stood still, unexploded. A car passed, heading toward the RV, and Josie ran to the parking lot, directing them to make a wide berth around the chateau.
"What is it?"
the man asked. He was a grandfather with three kids in the back seat. Gas was turned on, from the stove, Josie said.
You should turn it off,
Grandpa said. Thank you, Josie said. You're very helpful. He turned his station wagon around, and Josie crouched in front of Anna, who was holding her Thundercats figure in front of her in self-defense. How had she grabbed that on her way out? She had found time to grab her Thundercats figure while fleeing an imminent gas explosion. Did you know you almost caused a very bad accident? Josie asked her. Anna shook her head, her eyes wide but defiant. She turned the gas on?